I'll gladly paint what I've done. Well, I was reaching for the Bible, but I grabbed a gun. Well, I was reaching for the Bible, but
Mom, Dad, I'm in eighth grade now. That means those years of peer pressure are way behind me. From here on out, it's all about good grades and living up to your totally realistic expectations. Alcohol is probably the last thing on my mind. Like you said, I'm too young to drink. When I'm with my friends, all we talk about are current events and boy bands. We're definitely not curious about what alcohol tastes like or why the older kids drink. And do I notice when you have a drink at dinner? Of course not. Just like I haven't noticed where you keep the alcohol. Oh, and if the opportunity arises to talk to me about drinking, you should definitely continue to avoid it. And if you do bring it up, just remind me that I'm too young. That'll probably do the trick.
Real kids are curious about alcohol. 40% try it by the eighth grade. Start a real conversation at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. Talk early, talk often, get others involved. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Henry Ford. Newport Community College gift cards are a great way to show your support for someone in your life who is seeking the skills necessary to fulfill their dreams. Available in values from $10 to $100, gift cards can be used towards payment of tuition, purchasing books and supplies, lab fees, or even a lunch at Skylight Cafe. Gift cards can be purchased at the campus bookstore or online at collegestore.hfcc.edu. College gift cards. What better way to encourage a student in your life than with an investment in their future? The Global Village Party is a celebration of life, music overcoming boundaries and uniting cultures. So come on, join the party. That's the Global Village Party every Thursday from 2 to 4 on WHFR, the station making waves.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
And we really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is really very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click on the donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and
thank you for thinking.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is the moral cost of climate change.
Ken, we've really made a mess of this planet. We've chopped down the forests, we've burned all these fossil fuels. We're already beginning to see the devastating effects of climate change, and it's only going to get worse, especially if we pass the tipping point. The whole picture just fills me with gloom and dread.
You know, John, you're right. It's really dire stuff. And you know, the thing is, we've known about this for decades, but despite that, we continue to burn fossil fuels at the same rate as ever.
Worse than that, Ken, we've increased our rate of burning fossil fuels over the last couple of decades. The global community just can't seem to agree on a binding timeline to curb carbon emissions. Humans are hell-bent on making this planet uninhabitable for future generations.
I don't want to go quite that far. I mean, I think that most reasonable people, in their heart of hearts, they agree. They know we have a duty to our kids, to our grandkids, to pass on a planet where human life can still flourish.
Well, if that's where most humans are in their heart of hearts, then there must be something wrong with the system. There's some serious inertia somewhere. We recognize our moral responsibilities on some theoretical level, but when it comes to making actual changes and actually living different, nobody wants to pay the price and make the necessary sacrifice.
Call me a dreamer, John. Call me hopelessly naive. But you know, I'm not willing to give up hope. I still believe we can turn this thing around. I admit you're right. I mean, it's a complicated picture. There are major costs associated with changing our way of life and adapting to the emerging global climate. And it raises some crucial moral questions like, who ought to pay those costs? And how do we distribute the economic burdens in a fair and equitable way.
Well, Ken, I always do what you say, so I'm going to call you a hopelessly naive dreamer.
Okay.
But at any rate, you're right. Somebody's going to have to pay for the shift from a fossil fuel-based economy to something more sustainable, for redesigning the infrastructures that might make us less vulnerable to the severe weather that's coming and already here, and for responding to the growing number of climate catastrophes around the world. Historically speaking, it's America and the other industrialized nations who've benefited the most, who've used the carbon that is contributing to the problem. So it seems like we're the ones who ought to pay. Good luck.
Yeah. You know, it's not just that we're the most responsible for climate change. On the other hand, we're also, in a way, the least affected by it. I mean, we're richer than the rest of the world, and that allows us to adapt more easily to the increasingly severe conditions. Developing nations, first of all, they've never gotten to reap the full benefits of industrialization, and they're the most vulnerable to climate change, but because they are least able to afford to pay for the cost of adapting to it.
Well, this raises a moral dilemma. On the one hand, the first world has contributed to this damage, I think any reasonable person would agree, and reaped all the benefits. So it would be unfair for us now to demand that the developing world forego the use of carbon and pass up all the benefits of the sort we've gotten. How are they supposed to adapt to the changing climate if they don't have the technology and the industry to help them? On the other hand, the planet simply can't afford for the developing world to burn fossil fuels in the way we have. Morally speaking, it's a quagmire. It's a mess.
You know, you're right. And I think this is a really big issue. And we really need to rethink our idea of development, root and branch. I'm not just talking about the third world and how it's going to develop, but the first world, too. We have to seriously rethink our economic models. Those models are based on, you know, the idea of constant growth as the key to prosperity, which means ever more consumption. And you know, that's simply not sustainable anymore. But here's the thing. I have no idea whatsoever what's going to replace that old model.
Well, there's a lot to think about. Can we realistically entertain hope for the future in the face of global climate change? What kind of radical transformation is required for the survival of human generations? Can philosophers contribute to this in any way? Is there some concepts we could rethink or reformulate?
Those are hard and interesting and deep questions, John. And to help us start thinking about them, we ask our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, to find out the price some people are willing to pay to live more sustainably. She files this report.
This is how you make a sustainable latte. First, foam some local, organic, very cold milk, stamped with an actual seal of sustainability to the exact right temperature, about 150 degrees.
I love coffee.
Then prepare the coffee grounds from the organic fair trade micro roaster down the street. Be sure to use a very expensive Italian espresso machine that cuts energy use in half by falling asleep when idle. Pour the milk and enjoy. Or at least that's the way Dimitri Thompson does it.
Before we start the cafe, I went to the investors and said, listen, we're going to do the right way, the right thing, and we will make the profit.
Thompson's latest venture is what he claims to be the world's first carbon-neutral cafe, humbly named Noble Cafe. It opened in downtown Oakland in early 2012. Thompson's entire business plan revolves around reducing energy to bring the cafe's carbon footprint as close to zero as possible.
And I'm not by any means, you know, tree hugger, somebody who, you know, sleeps on a piece of wood. And you know, I go in hotel and I like to have a, you know, use three towels and keep the light on. But at the same time, I believe if I do all this, I need to do extra effort to offset that and to make the damage reverse.
Thompson's energy bill for 1 month last winter was less than $600, about half what other cafes the same size typically pay. But it's not just about bills. Thompson says the stakes are high, and he believes it's up to wealthier countries to take on climate change.
Because if we come to 2050, we will come to the point of no return. People in wealthy nations, doesn't matter if it's Sweden, UK, France, or US, they need to pay more because they made mass more.
Thompson is not just counting kilowatts. The tables are made of reclaimed local wood. There are no display fridges sucking energy all day long. Organic quiches made from local ingredients sit on top of cold plates. Even employee commutes are taken into consideration.
Every time when I employ somebody, I ask them how they come to work. if they are coming with a car, I ask them, is it 5 miles, how much gas they use, and I will transfer those into the CO2, CO2 into the dollars. And that will be part added on top of my electricity bill that is matched to Parks of Oakland.
Thompson donates about $500 a month to the Oakland Parks Department. It's his way of carbon offsetting on a local level. It may cost more up front, but in the end, Thompson believes his investment will pay off with long-term savings through lower energy bills.
Bottom line is, I am not non-profit. We are here all in business to make money, but I believe there is a moral price to be paid.
For now, it's too soon to tell if his business plan is actually working. Thompson says if Noble Cafe is still standing on the corner of Grand and Valdez Streets in Oakland a year from now, he'll consider it a success. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin. Even here in Oregon, maybe people can learn from this visionary in Oakland, of all places. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis.
And we're joined now by Alan Thompson. He's a professor of philosophy here at Oregon State University. He's co-editor of Ethical Adaptation to Climate Change, Human Virtues of the Future. Alan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Alan, environmental ethics is a pretty recent development in philosophy. What drew you to this new discipline?
Well, I had the good fortune of having parents who took me out into the woods and camping a lot as a child, where I would explore and find a kind of refuge in the ravines and beaches around my suburban Chicago home. But after that, really, and when I was in college, I was deeply moved by Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, published in 1989, really impressed by the tremendous sense of loss and a recollection of the kind of harms that would befall future human beings.
Well, despite all the dire predictions we keep hearing, there seems to be a lot of heel dragging going on when it comes to taking real action at the international level. Give us a straight dope. Is there anything humans can actually do about global climate change at this late date, or should we just hang our heads down, give up, and be pessimistic?
Well, you'd be right to be pessimistic if the thought was that we could prevent global climate change. Already we saw a half degree Celsius rise in the 20th century, and we're committed to that much more, even if we cut all carbon emissions tomorrow. You'd have grounds for pessimism if you thought that the international coordination towards limiting the mean surface temperature of the Earth below 2 degrees Celsius rise were to be successful. That doesn't look good.
Now, you mean limit it by the end of this century?
That's correct.
To 2 degrees Celsius change?
That's correct. That's the goal that the international community is rhetorically committed to, but some of the scientific models show that that will be extraordinarily difficult to achieve.
I want to emphasize something that you said really quickly. Suppose you said if we eliminated all carbon emissions, I don't know how possibly we'd do that. Live like monks, maybe, you know, like medieval. Mm-hmm. If everybody on the Earth lived without carbon emissions for however long.
Yeah.
You're saying it's global warming is still going to happen?
That's right. It's unfolding already, and we are committed already to about a degree and a half Celsius rise.
Now, a degree and a half Celsius rise, how severe of a rise is that? Is that cataclysmic environmental change, mild environmental change?
To my understanding, most climate scientists believe that a 2 degrees Celsius rise would be stabilize. And the question there
what
is...
What do you mean by stabilize?
But thank you. What I mean there is not provoking positive feedbacks, or the so-called tipping points, which would effectively take the propulsion of the climate change out of our hands.
So if we could keep it at 2 degrees, it's some possible that life might go on radically changed with lots of displacement of people, particularly in equatorial regions, but still pretty much not all that different. But if we get much beyond that, we might have things like the Gulf Stream closing down and all the things that make our climate pretty much what we have known and loved for a couple of millennia just disappear.
That's correct. I think, by and large, the stability we have seen through the last 10,000 years of the Holocene is in grave danger.
The Holocene is?
The last 10,000 years of the geologic period.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis. Our guest is Alan Thompson from Oregon State University. We're talking about the moral cost of climate change.
So, you've heard the bad news. Now, how do you think we should balance economic concerns with environmental concerns? Who should pay for implementing a more sustainable way of life? And what kind of responsibility do we have to future generations anyway? I mean, they're not even born yet. I mean, who cares?
The cost of climate change, along with questions from our live and lively audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Mama got a glacier in the fridge. Papa got a polar bear. Mama got an eagle in her purse. It looks a little worse for wear. We got swarms of bees up to our knees. A dog-faced bat just covered in fleas. Mama got a glacier in the fridge. Papa got a polar bear. He smells like salmon. Papa got a polar bear.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about the moral cost of climate change with Alan Thompson from Oregon State University.
Who do you think is responsible for taking measures to combat or minimize global climate change? Do you have any solutions to the cultural inertia that we seem to be experiencing when it comes to carbon emissions reductions? What kind of adjustments have you made to your life? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage.
So, Al, I want to take you back for a second. You mentioned the Holocene.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last 10,000 years?
Roughly
10,000 years. Now, I read somewhere, maybe it was in one of your articles, that we're entering a new age, the Anthropocene Age. Is that right?
That's what some are suggesting. I think it's Paul Crutzen, the climate scientist, who first suggested
it. What does that mean?
Can you say that slowly? Because I would like to throw these words around at the cocktail party. So, Holocene?
The Holocene and the Anthropocene.
Anthropocene. Okay.
Now, tell us what is going to characterize the Anthropocene, according to those who say we're entering a new age.
Well, it's the human impact on the planet measured on the geologic timescale.
Okay.
So, a little more than 10,000 years ago, we came out of the last ice age, and the temperature difference there in that ice age was about 4 to 5 degrees Celsius cooler than it is now. And so we can see climate change driving us in the opposite direction out of this relative 10,000-year band of climate stability that we call the Holocene.
So, wow, we've really impacted the Earth. But now look, okay, so we're entering this new global age, this new geological period, the Anthropocene. And it seems that the most vulnerable people in the developing world, they're neither responsible for climate change in the first place, nor do they have the means to protect themselves moving forward. On the other hand, we can't just let them grow like we've grown. So the thing seems like a mess. What do we do? First of all, who should foot the bill?
So really, questions about who's morally responsible to do something and who's responsible to bear these costs needs to be parsed in some way by the following sort of distinctions. We have individuals and we have nation states. We have developing nations, and we have developed nations, and we have presently existing people, and we have future generations of people. And these different parties could be the bearers of this cost. My view is the view that's accepted widely, both by theorists and in the political community, that it's the developed nations that bear the brunt and should take the lead in bearing the cost of
because we did the damage, so we pay the freight.
Largely, there's two ways to come at this. One is a kind of polluter pays principle. It was our mess, and we ought to clean it up. That's individual responsibility for the nation state. The other is a kind of justice in the distribution of a global commons.
But I want to play devil's advocate for a second.
Yeah.
So the developing nations developed technology, the Industrial Revolution, spread the benefits of the Industrial Revolution, you know, we all consume more, live longer, all this stuff. It wasn't like through evil intentions that we did this. In a way, you think it's a great success story, but a success story with unforeseen consequences. Now, if I do something, you know, the developing nations didn't intentionally do this damage.
Right.
They did it as a consequence of things that if the developing nations could have done, they would have done them too. We just did them first. We were more successful. So why should we have to pay disproportionate costs? I mean, maybe we should somehow, there's some burden sharing, but
yeah.
Should the developing nations just be left off the hook?
Well, so there's one sort of problem with assigning kind of fault liability. Just like you said, there's ignorance of the developed nations as they were industrializing and didn't know the consequences of these actions. That kind of excuse, as I'll call it, can't be sustained for too long. The science is well known for a good long time, and maybe with the IPCC report, the first one in the early 90s, we are in a position of no longer holding that ignorance to get us off the hook, yet we still continue to emit. Okay. Secondarily, it's not obvious to me and to most of the world's population that everybody is reaping the benefits of the advancements made by the first worlds in their industrializations. The distribution of wealth is quite unequal, and there are plenty of people who still live as though they were back in the Middle Ages.
So pay the cost. So what exactly does pay the cost mean? I mean, we should curtail our own growth and spending. Should we be aiding the developing nations in, I mean, what exactly does it mean for us to pay the cost and bear the burdens?
Well, there are costs of abatement in just those countries like ours who benefit from the use of fossil fuels, greenhouse gas emitting fossil fuels, gain great advantage from that, and we would have a lost opportunity to continue to gain in that sort of way. So that's a kind of cost, right? The mitigation costs,
okay.
Generally. There are also going to be costs in preparing less well-off countries to sustain their well-being, what they have of it, in the face of increasing climate impacts.
So, but now, as I understand it, there's really two different things we're talking about here. One is we really want to avoid more than a 2-degree change in the century if we can.
Yeah.
And we, even if we do that, there will be considerable displacement of peoples, places that were could sustain life before, won't be able to, so forth and so on. Somebody has to pay those costs. That's all serious business. But the other, and now more likely scenario, is that we'll well exceed the 2-degree climate change. There will be completely unforeseeable, well, maybe foreseeable, but which of the drastic foreseeable circumstances will take place, we don't know. Other maybe think the Gulf Stream may shut down. The peculiar life that they've been living in Europe, where they're, you know, roughly at the latitude of Edmonton and they live like they were at the latitude of Florida, that will all be gone. It's not just the poor and impoverished in Africa or Mexico or Ecuador that will be affected. It may be the whole nation of Oslo may be frozen over. There's incalculable changes.
Wait a minute, but John, you
we need to think about those and who should pay for those or what we should even do, how we begin to deal with it, not just who pays for these
best scenario type cases. I think that's exactly right, John, and part of the importance of your point is that the true costs of climate change are not all economic. We also face the most fundamental questions about how we should live, how we should, what kind of societies we want, how we should relate to the rest of the natural world and the other life in it. As you point out, as the climate starts to change and species go extinct of various kinds, we will have ecosystemic collapse, places will not be the way they were before, and we will have a changed world to live with.
So
these are different kinds of costs.
So let me ask you a question, just to sort out something that you and John said, just to slow down a little bit. Okay. There's a best-case scenario, which seems like a pretty bleak one, right? There's a best-case scenario and a worst-case scenario, and then I imagine in lots of gradations in between. But describe the best case and the worst case, just so we have a baseline here. What does the best case require of us, and what does the worst case require?
You mean in changing our lifestyles?
Yeah, yeah.
These sorts of questions?
Yeah, right.
Well, a lot has to do with how we're able to decarbonize our economy, okay? Because most we run today on a fossil fuel energy regime, and all of our activities and all of our economy is driven by greenhouse gas emitting energy sources, by and large. If we can decarbonize sufficiently, then there won't have to be much of a change in our first world lifestyles, right? But it turns out that we refuse to do this.
But even if we do that, and even if it is kept at 1.4, still the kind of things we've seen in northern and mid-Saharan Africa, the decrease of arable regions and the internecine battles between people that now don't have enough resources, right, that we like to say are must be due to Al-Qaeda, but they're really ultimately due to those are going to continue
at a
mad pace, even in the best case scenario.
So as I said earlier, we've already seen a 0.6 degree Celsius rise in the mean surface temperature. Many people are connecting the mad, crazy weather we've had this year more and more with global climate change. I think those are reasonable connections. We're already committed to 1.4 degrees Celsius if we cut the carbon off today.
Okay, I want to ask you a question. So go back to Caitlin's piece and the Noble Cafe. Suppose we all just decided we're going to zero out our carbon input, our footprint as much as we can. You know, I'm going to turn down my lights. I'm going to buy local. I'm going to just do all those things.
Get the expensive espresso machine.
Right. Would that solve the problem?
No.
So it's not much I can do as an individual or all of us in this room can do collectively to substantially impact this problem?
Well, collectively is quite different than the kind of individual actions you take day to day, which are connected with the emissions of greenhouse gases, right? There is nothing you can do as an individual through individual actions to either bring about or prevent global climate change. We do have to act collectively in groups larger than this so that it's at the nation-state level with policies putting caps on carbon emissions.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the moral cost of climate change at Oregon State University. We're in front of a live and lively audience here, and we have questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Tell us your
name and where you're from, and then state your question.
Yeah, my name is Rob Dietz, and I'm from Corvallis. And I wanted to note that this year is the 40th anniversary since the book The Limits to Growth was published. And since then, a bunch of economists have been promoting this idea of transitioning to a steady state economy, which is an economy that seeks to meet people's needs without continuous growth and especially without undermining the life support systems of the planet. But that kind of economy gets no play in our universities or among politicians. And my question is, why? Why, economically speaking, can't we figure out when enough is enough?
Good question.
It's an excellent question.
Yeah.
let me ask you, I'll challenge you. Name me an economy in the world in modernity that has run on that principle.
I can't name it. Almost every economy is hell-bent on growth. That's the overriding philosophy, if you will.
Because, I mean, let's just think about this a little bit. Because population keeps growing, right? People's needs keep increasing. The demand we put on the earth in order to satisfy all these ever-increasing desires and needs and all that stuff. There has to be more and more and more.
Yeah, but I mean, there's ideas play a role here. I mean, before Adam Smith, people didn't have the idea of capital and so forth. And before Keynes, they didn't have the idea that growth was the way out of economic problems in the business cycle. So there's room for some new ideas, aren't there?
What do you think?
I think we have to be careful to distinguish the needs that people have, that human beings have, and these do not obviously continue to grow from the desires that people have in our largely consumer culture and the kind of picture of well-being that the first world is exporting to the third world, which just is to satisfy largely your consumer desires, get more wealthy, grow the economy to better satisfy your consumer desires. Population increase does drive the number of people who have needs to be satisfied, and this is a driver of many, many environmental problems, including climate change, but it's not the desires themselves that are
well. But you think I grant there's an intuitive distinction between desires and needs, but I don't really know how to draw that distinction. Does the caveman need the things that I need? Right, my needs are shaped by the context in which I live. I live in a highly technological, highly globalized, interconnected environment. And so given that, I have certain needs. You could say, well, those are desires, mere desires rather than needs, because look, the cavemen didn't have those. How do we, in principle, distinguish the needs from a desire?
That's an enormously difficult task. We can bring it down, of course, to the sort of basic bodily needs for food and shelter and these sorts of things. But then beyond that, you're quite right that it hinges on all sorts of technologies.
Well,
that
I mean, it's a little bit like pornography. I may not be able to define it, but when I see designer shoes, I know that's a desire and not a need. And when I see protein, I know that's need and not a desire.
Right? Well, there you go.
I'm a desire and a need.
And I will say that there are philosophers who've produced sort of more objective lists of what it is to live well as a human being rather than satisfying.
Like Martha Nussbaum, who wears very nice shoes.
let's take another question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hello, my name's Aaron. I'm representing the vegans and vegetarians at Oregon State University. And while there is scientific evidence to support that a vegan diet can do more to offset the carbon footprint than taking multiple cars off the road permanently, why do you think it's so hard for people to make such an ethically rewarding and cost-efficient choice?
To become vegans?
Yeah.
Because it means not eating meat and eggs.
Why do you think it's so hard?
Well, I think people are tied into their desires, like you said, but I'm curious why people value the desires so much over what it obviously needs.
Hazard a guess that you are a vegan?
Yes.
And you find it rewarding?
Yes, very.
What'd you have for dinner?
Beans and rice.
So, Alan, do you have a comment about that? Or do we move on to the next one?
Of course, it's a psychological question largely about why people can't overcome their weakness of will, even if they're committed to certain kinds of ideas or of the good and are unable to realize it. We're plagued by this problem in many ways. I would turn mostly to the sort of conception of how we form these desires through habituation. And it's being raised as a meat eater that many of us were that deeply instills these kind of desires that makes them very
well. It's also, but there is a point. There is a deeper point. I mean, if Michael Pollan's book, what is it called? Omnivore's Dilemma, and which he follows the food around, you know, he shows you how cows are raised. It's disgusting.
Pink
and,
slime.
And if that, and if the reality of how we live could be manifest to people and the cost of that reality, I think some of these things would be easier to change.
But still, again, there's two issues. I mean, even if we all become vegans and buy good espresso machines and drive Priuses or Volts, things are going to be dire. But understanding the difference between needs and desires and having some economic model based on that, that might be useful even in the catastrophe, for the world after the catastrophe. So people could kind of have some conception that, well, you know, maybe we don't have designer shoes like they did in the 20th century and the first part of the 21st century, but, you know, we can meet our needs. We can still read philosophy and eat lettuce and a few other things that are essential.
I think the kind of hope that we can have is that people on the other side of the environmental crisis, if there is any sort of recognizable civilization at all, will be living a substantially different form of the good life than we pursue it today, and we have rather faulty conceptions of what human goodness is, and reconceiving and reinvesting in the satisfaction of our needs before our just desires is an important part of
that. That's a really, you're tiptoeing up to a really deep and hard question. I think we really want to dig into that deep and hard question in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the moral cost of climate change with Alan Thompson from Oregon State University.
So what possibility is there for human flourishing in the face of what seems like the likely impending climate catastrophe? Is there still hope for some kind of radical transformation? And if so, is that what's that transformation going to look like?
We're coming to you from Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. We'll take more questions from our live and very lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Got me a job in a think tank, you know, thinking up the worst case scenarios. Bigfoot coming to the Bible Belt, hyenas go mad on the African veldt, go-go ice cap melt on the desert sands of Ontario. Monster tornadoes, hypercanes, super clones bringing acid rain, fireball clusters on a darkened plain. Nothing but a worst-case scenario. Not believing something doesn't make it not so. Nothing but a worst-case scenario. I'm just saying, might not be so. Nothing but a worst-case scenario.
Let's hear it for our live musical guests, Merle Kessler, Amy Kessler, and Devin Strolovich, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're in Corvallis, Oregon, with Alan Thompson from Oregon State University, and we're talking about the moral cost of climate change in front of a live and lively audience here. We've got more questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. I'm Dave. I'm from Corvallis. And you've already mentioned effectively that climate change is just a symptom of the real problem, which is human population growth. Is there any hope of solving the climate problem without stopping or even reversing population growth? And what are the moral implications of that?
You know, the well-known formula, the IPAT, human impact on the planet, is a product of population affluence and our technologies. So while population is a driver, it is constrained in its way or moderated by the kind of lifestyles that we conduct ourselves in and the technologies that we have. So I don't want to put the pin just on population growth, although that is a fundamental driver. It's population growth occurring mostly in the third world, as you know, but it takes about 7 third world citizens, I'll generalize here, to have an equal impact on the planet as 1 first world citizen.
It seems to me, tell me if you think this is an overstatement or not, It seems to me that this is a huge moment in human history. One of my favorite philosophers, well, at least one of my favorite philosophical rhetoricians, is Nietzsche. And he wrote at a time when he thought that the foundations of European civilization, the philosophical foundations, had crumbled. And all the things upon which European thought were based, he just rejected. But he wasn't just a naysayer. He was trying to envision a new forward, a new culture. It was like a clarion call. He had this thing, philosophers of the future, embark, right, and think up the culture of the future. It seems to me that our relationship to the Earth is so stressed and so it needs such change that we really need to rethink almost everything about human life, human collectivities, human societies, human economies. So we're in a moment that calls for like deep, profound rethinking of our mission on this planet. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that that's true, and it, of course, is not a new message from the environmental side that we need to rethink our relations with the non-human world and our modes of civilization. It's just a finer point is put on it, given the growing awareness we have of the emerging climate crisis and the small window that we have to respond to it.
But I want to ask you something. This touches on something. Some people on the right deny the reality of climate change, and it's denial born of something, of a deep insight or a deep fear. I don't know if it's an insight or just an irrational fear that the things we have to do to come to grips with this are antithetical to capitalism. So that if we're going to cope with climate change, capitalism has to go. And the capitalist class says, we're not going anywhere. I mean, is that an oversimplification?
But I mean, the socialist economies have not done particularly well by the environment. If we really, truly paid the cost of carbon in the way that, say, a sincere libertarian would have us do, we'd be a lot better off.
So what do you think? Can we cope with this and remain free market capitalists?
Well, I am not an economist and don't have an expert opinion on these things, although I will say that there are individuals out there like Herman Daly who have models of steady-state economies, which were mentioned earlier, and while they haven't been deployed large-scale in a way to find whether they will be successful or not, and it's population growth that does drive largely the ability of our consumer class to grow and drive the economy. It's a finite planet, and the population cannot grow indefinitely, nor can our economy.
So you don't have an expert, but do you have a hunch about capitalism and compatibility?
Yeah, I think that it has to stop.
Okay. on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
My name is Bob West. I'm from Corvallis. My question is, this is philosophy talk, so are there things that philosophers can or are doing? Are there new philosophies, new philosophers, new philosophical works going on right now around us that it would be good for us to know about and who are exploring this in some ways as philosophers?
Yeah.
You know, looking back at the like 20th century philosophy, Anglo-American philosophy, is this going to help us out?
Yeah, but you may have missed something I said. I think this is a huge cultural moment. I compared it to Nietzsche. It's rethinking everything about human life on this planet. But now, can some philosopher just instantaneously tell you the answer? No, but here's what we can do. We can give you a clarion call that the question is, what is the human self? What is the human self in a human community? What are human communities? What are the borders of a human community? We talk about the developing world and the developed world, but it's one world, and everything that we do reverberates throughout this one world. So I think it's a... I don't have the answers, but the questions.
But your question is really... I think can be answered in this way. I mean, Martha Nussbaum is a person who's working on this distinction between needs-based and want-based or desire-based. Amartya Sen, who's a very good philosopher and economist, has done a lot of interesting work. There are some radical proposals out there from people like Peter Singer about how we ought to be relating to the natural world. So on the whole, it probably... fair to say that 20th century American philosophy has mostly consisted of people like Ken and I that are interested in proper names and the analytic synthetic distinction and are hoping to contribute to larger issues. But there are some out there that are really doing it, and Ellen can give
you
some more names.
You think the capacities approach has some, Martha Nussbaum stuff has some...
Well, the central importance to that for my work from my perspective is that it casts an objective theory of human flourishing and the human good, which is an alternative to the models of satisfying our consumer-based desires. I will say that the global environmental crisis, driven largely by global climate change, at least in the forefront, raises all sorts of new issues about our moral obligations to future generations, which we had not had to puzzle before. It turns out that the efforts and the sweat of previous generations in the past had always just bequeathed to future generations more social capital and greater wealth. But as it was mentioned earlier, we're reaching the limits of that sort of thing now, so we have new problems relating to future generations, and also questions like geoengineering and manipulating the whole
biosphere. So the future generations are a puzzle. Philosophers puzzle about this kind of thing. They don't exist. So how can I have an obligation to something that doesn't exist?
Well, we know that they're coming, right? There will be future individuals. We know they're coming. There's very puzzling issues here about their identity and the policies that we choose today in determining which unique individuals exist in the future. And so sometimes people say, oh, there's grave difficulty here. Attributing rights to any individuals in the future because these are non-existent, but there will be some people.
So there's an example that's used in some of this literature. I mean, if I'm a madman and I plant a bomb in an elementary school that's designed to go off in 10 years, well, when it goes off in 10 years, the children it kills won't have been born yet. But that doesn't mean it wasn't a bad thing and that I didn't do it to them.
Well, that's
a good point, man.
That's good. Let's take another question from our audience here.
Hi, I'm Ben Wishnick from Corvallis, Oregon. I had a quick question for Dr. Thompson. How important is the applied practice of ecological restoration and restoring humans' relationship with the environment, as well as mediating the effects of climate change?
That's a great question, Ben. Thank you for it. It turns out that the practices of ecological restoration are on the forefront of our ability to learn and exercise some human capacity to undo some of the damage we have done to ecological systems sort of in the micro. And from my perspective, these stand as very valuable experiments and models for returning to a greater state of ecological health, the global biosphere.
But we're not going to there's no chance, it sounds like, of us rewinding the world to some prior, more pristine state. That's just not in the cards, right?
That's absolutely correct. And what most of us have thought was pristine wilderness here in the North American continent actually wasn't. And better environmental history has shown us that the Native Americans were active land managers all across. And it really doesn't make much sense to imagine the world as it might have been without human beings at all.
Hi, my name's Thomas McElhinney. I'm a student here at Oregon State. And during the end of the last section, I think you guys were walking up to a really interesting question about if it is the case that the United States, let's just say loosely, values something like individual liberty, given the fact that so many of our individual actions actually cause harm to others, and it's built on some version of liberalism which says you can act insofar as you don't harm other people, does the reality of climate change undermine liberalism?
That's a darn good question. What do you think, Alan? You mean liberalism in a broad sense, not liberals versus conservatives. That's just to make it clear.
So it gives us good content to come back to the question earlier about the operation of capitalism, which is a largely individual liberalist sort of framework for the pursuit of gaining wealth as long as you aren't causing undue harm or unjustified harm to others. There are real difficulties in assigning responsibility for the harms from climate change to individual actors, and so we don't seem to have any constraints on limiting their liberty and on the basis of these harms. I think we ought to perhaps flip the burden of proof and rather think instead that all of our actions, at least in the consumer first world lifestyle that you and I live in, are contributing to harms of future generations, and that we instead have to, the burden of proof you see is shifted, and we have to justify these actions instead of having to justify the claim that we are responsible for.
Right.
But let me just put in 2 cents for liberalism. When we have somebody that's polluting the environment, polluting the air, releasing carbon in the atmosphere, and we know that they're harming their neighbors, we know that by the standards of liberalism, they have gone past those actions that don't affect others. What's lacking is not the philosophy of liberalism, but the guts to do something about it.
You have time for one last question. You're going to be our final questioner.
Okay. My name is Leah Bossler. I'm a student here at Oregon State as well. My question gets back to technology. One can say that technology is the reason why we got in this climate change mess. Given that the first world is more technologically advanced, is it the responsibility of the first world to distribute, quote, green and efficient technologies? Or is it rather the responsibility of the first world to learn from the third world on how to be less consumptive?
Excellent question. I will say that it's not obvious that citizens in the third world would be less consumptive if they had the wealth that we have. It's pretty clear that the kind of lifestyle choices and the picture of the good life that's exported to them all the time is highly desirable, and they want to live like we do, and if they had the wealth, they would probably engage in the same kind of practices. So there's not a lot of learning, I think, going in that direction. It turns out that in order to help the third world develop and grow their economies so that they can bring the impoverished people up to some minimal standard of living, or minimal standard that we would recognize as characteristic of a civilized form of life, they are going to need to develop in ways that do not depend on fossil fuels and will depend on technology transfers and reliable financing from us in order to do that green energy technology.
Has there ever been a human society that did not depend on carbon to generate energy, carbon-based things to generate energy?
No.
So this would be an unknown thing in human history.
That is correct. Yeah, that's correct. It will be radically unprecedented.
How is this going to happen?
It's not going to happen, Ken. We're not going to decarbonize before we reach something like 2 degrees or greater Celsius increase in the mean surface temperature of the planet. We have to begin adapting in more ways than preparing for climate impacts and protecting our form of life today as we know it against more severe storms and these sorts of things, adapting ourselves to a new global ecology.
On that call to a new order, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Alan Thompson. He's professor of philosophy at Oregon State University. He's co-editor of Ethical Adaptation to Climate Change, Human Virtues of the Future. So, John, what are you thinking now? Are you more optimistic, more pessimistic?
Oh, I'm always pessimistic about almost everything, except maybe the giants. I always like to think things through in biblical terms, as you know, Ken.
No, I didn't know that.
I'm thinking the Holocene era that we've been in for a millennium or two.
10,000 years.
10,000 years, a millennium or 10. That's the Garden of Eden. Whatever we thought about it, it was a blip in the history of the world that made everything we like possible. And now we're going into this thing, you know, we ate the apple big time.
Yeah.
And we're thrusting ourselves out into the Anthropocene era. And it would have been good if Adam and Eve had a little time to think over what they were getting into, and maybe we're blessed with that, and philosophy can make some contribution.
Now, look, I think you're very much right that the life to which we've been accustomed is not possible anymore, and that's a huge moment in political, economic, philosophical, cultural history. And I think it's like Nietzsche said: embark, philosophers; embark, economists; embark. We have to reimagine human life, and that's in some ways that's really exciting.
Well, I mean, what if Portland warms up and the beaches are sunny all year round? Could Oregonians bear that? I mean,
no. I don't know the answer to this question, but I do know that this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is "Cogito ergo blogo," I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page and by following our tweets on Twitter.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk. You do that by going to our website, which is philosophytalk.org. Now, we go green and fast with Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, many sacrifices have been made in the ongoing controversy about climate change, among them, strangely, Dr. Seuss. Now, I'm a big fan of Dr. Seuss, though The Lorax is not one of my favorites. It's the story of the Onceler, who found he could make thneeds from chopped down truffula trees. This causes the Lorax, who talks to trees, to confront the Onceler, saying, quote, "Now, since you've chopped the trees to the ground, there's not enough truffula fruit to go round, and my poor barbaloots are all feeling the crummies because they have gas and no food in their tummies," unquote. Well, a little bit of this sort of thing makes me want to curl up with some Mickey Spillane. Anyway, it was released as a movie, joining a truly terrible tradition of bloated movies made from trim little Dr. Seuss books. How the Grinch Stole Christmas with Jim Carrey, The Cat in the Hat with Mike Myers, movies that seem to have been carefully inspected by experts to make sure there was not even one speck of charm remaining. Now, I haven't seen The Lorax and won't. Just seeing the preview made me cringe, and that was 30 seconds. Who wants to sit in a movie theater and cringe for 2 hours? But there was a backlash. Lou Dobbs and the Fox Business Network called it insidious nonsense from Hollywood and claimed it was trying to indoctrinate children. That was pretty much the typical conservative response, The Lorax's anti-capitalist global warming propaganda. The left, on the other hand, went after the movie because of unfortunate choices of brand tie-ins. Truffula chip pancakes at IHOP, for instance. The Lorax image can be found on seventh-generation diapers and packages of Yo Kids yogurt. He's marketing an HP printer. Target, Comcast, Xfinity, and others got a piece of the tree hugger as well with online games and sweepstakes. Most egregiously, to the left, Mazda had a Lorax tie-in. According to the Huffington Post, Mazda, in partnership with the National Education Association, used school time to expose students, some of them even kindergartners, to a sales pitch. At one school assembly, the Lorax hugged kids while a Mazda executive encouraged children to persuade their parents to test drive the SUV. The children are then led outside the school to view a Lorax-decorated car as the Mazda rep assured them that the CX-5 is the kind of car we think the Lorax would want to drive. In exchange for this, supposedly Mazda gave $25 to the school library. So, the right got it wrong, if you can believe that. The Lorax is definitely pro-capitalism. He's got an SUV, for God's sake, or would if he weren't fictitious and had a driver's license. None of this brouhaha affected the box office of The Lorax. The movie did so well, in fact, Universal has greenlighted a CGI version of Cat in the Hat. Personally, I'm looking forward to Bartholomew and the Oobleck, with Brad Pitt as Bartholomew and John Carpenter's The Thing guest starring as the Oobleck. Get on that, Hollywood, and I've got the perfect product tie-in. Jell-O Oobleck pudding. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Miletta Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Merle Kessler, Amy Kessler, and Devin Strolovich, the Playtones.
Special thanks to Bill Ugalis, Dwayne Howard, the OSU School of History, Philosophy, and Religion, the Associated Students of Oregon State, Tina Green Price, and the staff of the LaSalle Stewart Center.
Thanks also to Joel Groves, Jason Rappaport, Caitlin Ash, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And that's a wrap. And thank you for coming. That was fun.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Host Analytics, a provider of cloud corporate performance management and business analytics, offering products working to impact financial decisions for over a decade. More information at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, it is so good to talk to you again, man.
And to you, Kai. I missed you, too. How's your summer been?
Good. Busy, but good.
Good. Tis, of course, the season for outdoor activity,
yeah.
Some of which I'm here to tell you can have a very significant downside.
What, like sunburn and mosquito bite? What?
No, I'm actually talking about death. So I hate to be a killjoy in the middle of summer.
Okay.
But I thought it might be worthwhile to look at the relative danger of some of America's favorite summertime activities.
All right.
Okay, so let's start with motorcycling. Here's Randa Samaha from the National Crash Analysis Center.
Okay.
Motorcyclists are very vulnerable road users. For every 100 million vehicle mile traveled, there are over 24 riders killed.
So when I was 20-something years old, I told my grandfather that I wanted to buy a motorcycle, and he said, I would sooner kill you with my bare hands. He was a doctor.
Good advice, yeah. Okay. I don't know if you own a boat, Kai,
but the
boating statistics are a little bit frightening. Here's Mike Barron with the U.S. Coast Guard.
We're roughly down to about, you know, say 6.2 deaths per every 100,000 boats.
And swimming, something most of us do. I do a lot of that in the summer. Here's Julie Gilchrist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Overall, the drowning rate in the United States for all ages is 1.29 per 100,000.
Huh. And I couldn't find any stats on golfing deaths. That's what I spend, you know, my free time. I think that's relatively safe. But skydiving, here's Nancy Corrine from the U.S. Parachute Association.
Wow. There's been an average of maybe 22 fatalities a year. Which is about 7 per 1 million skydives.
Okay, wait, so 7 per million versus all those others,
not so many.
No, not so bad, right?
So, you know, the motorcycle death rate is based on the number of miles traveled. Swimming deaths, meanwhile, are counted on a per capita basis. Skydiving deaths based on the number of jumps, and, of course, a lot fewer.
Of risk.
You know, Kai, this raises an interesting point. If an activity is prima facie dangerous, maybe it scares people away from adding a layer of danger by drinking, you know?
Hang on a minute, right? Because motorcycling is prima facie, although I always thought it was prima facie, but it's prima facie dangerous, but people drink and motorcycle all the time.
Well, to some people it is, and to some people plainly it's not. I mean, I tend to agree with you, especially riding bike without a helmet. You know, helmets are estimated to prevent about 40% of crash deaths among motorcyclists, and yet there are a lot of bikers out there who would much prefer to ride a bike than to not, and to ride a bike without a helmet. Look, if safety is your number one concern this summer, I'm not saying it should be, but if it is, I've got the ultimate activity for you and everybody.
All right, what's
out
up?
There.
Hit me with it.
You stay inside, you listen to your radio.
Stephen Dubner.
Taking the coward's way out. Yep.
That's right. Hey, man, I'm all right with that.
Hey, podcast listeners, coming up on next week's podcast, the second half of our two-part episode, Freakonomics Goes to College. The central question, is a college degree really worth all that money and effort? And I asked Steve Levitt about the magic that happens in the college classroom.
So obviously, I teach my students. I teach them very specific things. But I know that when I talk to them years later, they don't remember anything that I taught them. I mean, I can ask them the most simple questions about the material we covered, and they have no recollection whatsoever, the typical students.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Well, he moved early. That's going to draw the yellow flag.
Offsides, number 72, 5 yards.
Check out this fan leaving the game. He's headed straight up the middle and right into a sobriety checkpoint. Let's see how he handles it.
No, officer, I haven't been drinking. I'm the designated driver.
Upon further review, this fan made the right call by being a designated driver.
Sign up to be the designated driver at the stadium and always buckle up, provided as a public service by the station and Team Coalition.
W-A-Z-